This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Okay, be honest. Before last week, when U.S. prosecutors indicted top officials from FIFA, soccer's global governing body, had you ever heard of Sepp Blatter? I'd heard the name, but it meant nothing to me. Now, Blatter's resignation as FIFA president right after his controversial re-election amidst the scandal has the American media talking about how it's time for soccer reform. British comedian John Oliver, who makes his money and home in the U.S., recognizes the irony.
I don't know what I'm more surprised by, that FIFA officials were actually arrested or that America was behind it. It took the country that cares the least about football to bring down the people who have been ruining it. That's like finding out that Kesha arrested a group of bankers involved in commodities fraud.
America's always had this ambivalent attitude toward the beautiful game, even as the sport permeates our suburban neighborhoods. Remember soccer moms as a voting bloc? It's never really taken off as a professional sport here, but as the nation's community of immigrants from around the world who see soccer as the only sport, well, as that grows, this sport is becoming more popular by the day. Now, with the rotten core of FIFA exposed and with the Women's World Cup starting next week, is it time for another soccer boom? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Are you involved in youth soccer? Are you a fan of the international game? What's your take on FIFA and the scandal that has enveloped the sport? We'd like to hear from you. Joining us in studio today is Sean Mecki, who's a color analyst for CPTV Sports' coverage of soccer. He's director of goalkeeping at the FSA FC Youth Soccer Club in Farmington, and he's the manager of operations for Soccer Plus Camps. Sean, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
Tom Loke is here as well. He's president of the American Outlaws, the Hartford chapter. It's an organization of U.S. soccer fans. Tom, welcome to the show.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Kristen Huber is joining us from our New Haven studios. She's director of the Connecticut Football Club, general manager of the CFC Arena and Hamden Hall soccer coach. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, I'll just start with you, Tom, but I'd like everyone to weigh in. You know, your group, American Outlaws, is a group of diehard soccer fans. How does the news of this FIFA scandal resonate with you and the other members?
Well, the news has been taken pretty well. We're very excited that it's finally coming to light. It's been a tough battle. You know, I mean, we know that there is corruption. It's never really kind of come to surface. We're glad that the United States is kind of behind bringing this thing down. So we're kind of a proud moment.
Sean, how about you? I mean, this is something that, as John Oliver says, as every sports writer who's covered this for even a minute says, this is not a surprise, but yet now it's sent these shockwaves through the sport. What's your reaction?
Well, I think in some ways there's a little bit of pride as an American that it is the United States Department of Justice that's kind of leading the charge, and it's something that's been a long time coming. But for our government to be playing a role in kind of bringing about a lot of this change, or at least providing the catalyst for it, we take a little bit of pride in that, I think, as the American soccer community.
How well known was it amongst the American soccer community, Sean, that this was a problem, that essentially this was an organization that had corruption in it, that as much as we love the game, as much as we love watching the sport, we were essentially watching a sport that was run by people who were skimming off the top at the very best, or outright stealing and causing all sorts of problems at the very worst? I mean, it seems as though it's been going on. Is this something that everyone knew all the time?
Well, I think anyone who followed the sport very closely, even here in America, where the media coverage is nothing to the extent of what it is in other parts of the world, you always knew that FIFA was a corrupt organization, that it had become a problem. But really, the watershed moment was in 2010 when FIFA announced the 2018 and 2022 World Cup bid. The hosting announcement, and the story came out that Qatar would be hosting the World Cup in 2022. I think that was the moment that it really became very obvious to everyone how incredibly important it was to clean up the corruption with inside the organization.
Because there's an awful lot of things that you can hide as far as corruption, but when a country as small but as obviously rich as Qatar is given the games, you see the human rights abuses that are happening in the building of the facilities, and then, Tom, just the obvious fact that you can't play soccer in the middle of the summertime in a place that's going to be 120 degrees. I mean, what did that say to you when this happened? As Sean says, did it just say, well, look, this is broken, this has got to be fixed?
Well, exactly. How can you give a country, you know, that allows slave labor, a country that can't host a game in the summer, you know, how can you actually accept that you gave them the World Cup?
It's something that maybe will change, and we'll see how that happens. Christine Huber, I'd like your take on this, because anytime a sport is thrown into scandal, there's a chance, obviously, for reform. It has the side benefit of a lot of people talking about soccer who may not have been talking about soccer. Is this overall good for the game that you love?
I think in the United States, like the guy said, in 2010, we were slated and we were one of the few countries to put in a bid for the World Cup for 2022. And when it came to Qatar, which, you know, I think everyone was surprised about, that hurt the United States. It hurts our growth in soccer here and obviously the economic effects of bringing the World Cup back to the United States.
So I'm wondering, with a Women's World Cup coming up, is this going to be affected, do you think, by what's happening with FIFA?
No, the Women's World Cup is already set in Canada. I don't think the trickle-down effect is going to happen. I think what's going to happen is we'll find out if Qatar is really going to get the World Cup in 2022. I believe right now they're saying yes, it's going to stay there. But with all the jurisdictions and everything coming down, who knows?
Christine, I'd like you to just talk for a moment about what the sport means to you. And I want to get everyone to sort of weigh in on this. It's really important for me to get to something about the game that goes beyond just scandal and obviously beyond how popular it is as a professional sport or how popular it is as an amateur sport. Tell me, Christine, why you love the game.
I've been playing since I've been five. I've been involved in coaching and, you know, played all the way up through. I mean, I still play now. So it's important. It's a good game. It is, I believe, the most popular sport in the United States for youth and children. The participation just keeps growing. So you'll see it. Everyone's now watching the World Cup. We're now televising more games than ever before in any Women's World Cup.
Televising more games than ever before, and that's something we're going to be talking about more. Television is, of course, a really big part of this game. Maybe, Tom, you can tell me about this. Why do you love this game so much? Why does it matter so much to you?
You know, it's kind of hard to put into words. I've just always loved soccer. I grew up playing it. You know, I've always loved following the sport. It was kind of more of a, you know, the World Cups when we were kids, it wasn't as available as it is now, but it was kind of something that you had to reach for. And I think, you know, a lot of kids do grow up playing, and you know it translates into, you know, becoming soccer fans later in life. It's cool to see how much more available the game's become as the digital media kind of helps out. I mean, you talk about watching it on TV. Also, you got to consider the video game FIFA. I mean, how many kids, you know, play that game? You know, build a favorite team, build a favorite player. And, you know, kind of go from there. You know, the game is growing in so many different ways. It's fun to watch.
The video game aspect of it is really interesting, and it's not something I would have thought of. I may be a little bit out of the age range of playing video games, but you said that it's actually had a real impact on growing the sport.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at a lot of people and, you know, they're not huge soccer fans, but you bring up the video game FIFA and they say, oh, yeah, let's play. You know, they can tell you who the teams are. They can tell you who the players are. And before the game got really popular, I don't know if anybody can tell you all those different things. So it's kind of helping the awareness of the sport and, you know, who the big players are, who the teams are, who we're watching on TV. It's really helping in so many ways.
Sean, what do you love about this game?
Oh, I mean, it's the single reason that I own an Xbox. It's not just another extension of my love for this sport. But it's also a really well-built game. I mean, people who are not really that into soccer but are into video gaming love this game because the gameplay is just so intricate and natural feeling. It's an incredible game.
Okay, so beyond the game on the field, when did you start playing?
I started playing when I was four.
When you were 4 years old?
Yeah.
And was it the only sport for you at the time, or have you always played other sports?
No, I was a multiple sport athlete for years and years and years, but at the end of the day, the number one passion was always soccer.
When you teach young players, why is it that they're into the game? What is it they tell you about what they love about soccer? Because obviously we're in this age of specialization, even with youth sports, right? If somebody gets really good at soccer, they're probably going to play soccer all year round, maybe not do what you did and play all the other sports too. What is it they tell you they love about the game?
Well, I think, you know, for different people, there are different reasons that they love the game. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so popular is, you know, it's a sport that allows multiple types of athletes to have success by playing different roles within the team. As a team sport, you do form those bonds and build out that sense of community. So, you know, I think there's certainly a social factor to it that makes it so attractive to young students and young players. But also just the fact that whatever your body type, whatever your stronger attribute is as an athlete, there's a role for that within the team.
Were you a goalkeeper?
I was a goalkeeper, yes.
Yeah, I was a goalkeeper in high school, too. And you know why? we didn't have to run as much. I'm just being completely honest with you. I was a tall guy and I didn't want to run as much, but I always loved the game. If you love the game, give us a call, 860-275-7266. Teague is calling from Wallingford. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
I felt like the need to call in. I actually run the New Haven Gooners, which is the Arsenal America branch for the state of Connecticut. And in the last 6 to 7 years, through two World Cup cycles, we've seen the amount of people that come out to the pub to watch European soccer with us to have grown exponentially, especially after the work that people like Tom have done with the American Outlaws, getting people excited for the sport over the summertime. Last year, my team Arsenal were in the FA Cup final, and we had close to, I'll say, 100 people come to our final party. And this year, just this last weekend, when we retained the cup, we had close to 200. So I think that the European game, specifically with the fact that it's in the morning, that people can watch it before they go have a day on their weekend, or it's not competing with other sports at the time, is getting pretty big, and we're seeing really big numbers come through our club.
It's really interesting. And Teague, hang on the line too, because I want to ask Tom about that. I've been at bars in the morning watching soccer from Europe before. I've also been there in the afternoon watching World Cup games, and you see people crowd in for the international game. How is it different that the American sport is something that we have? MLS is a very good brand of soccer. There's other professional leagues around the United States. How is it that the European game, or maybe the global game, is what people will flock to far before they're maybe willing to spend money on a ticket to a game right here?
Well, you know, I don't want to step on any toes. The MLS is growing to become a great league, but the attractive football is overseas. I mean, the competition levels are higher. The teams are better. They've been performing for longer. And, you know, the game's growing here, which is great to watch, but I think a lot of people do enjoy watching the big names, the big clubs, you know, the big competitions, Champions League, things of that nature.
Is that about right to you, Teague? Is the game over there just better to watch?
They have a pretty big head start on the MLS here. And although the MLS has grown in leaps and bounds and is actually putting on a far superior product than they did 20 years ago, there's no question that, you know, the NFL-style quality of the game is coming out of England and Spain and Germany, not America quite yet. Another thing that I think is a big factor is that in America, I believe soccer is kind of thought of as a summer sport, and the amount of running and movement that you guys are talking about, the World Cup possibly being in Qatar in the desert. Soccer is meant to be played in kind of cooler weather, in the rain, and I think that the game is faster because of that, and I think that appeals more to people, whereas when it's really hot, the action tends to slow down a bit.
Yeah, just like the rest of life slows down in the middle of the summertime. Teague, thank you so much for the phone call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Allison, who's calling from West Hartford. Hi, Allison. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing well. What's up?
I have a question about kind of where you see this decision affecting the women's game in the long term. Obviously, you've kind of addressed that, you know, it's not really going to do anything for the upcoming World Cup, but, you know, where do you see some of that trickle effect being in the eventually?
Christine, what do you say to Allison?
Like I said, I think now everything's set for this World Cup, but looking forward, it's the same thing. I mean, I think that would help our chances in getting the bid again back at the United States.
Allison, I notice here that you're a former pro soccer player yourself.
I did, yeah. I played in Boston for a couple of years, and I was actually under Sean's tutelage for a short period of time as well.
Oh yeah. So what do you see as the state of the women's game? I mean, I think we are all enthralled with that Women's World Cup win on U.S. soil, and Brandi Chastain, and right. It seems as though it's again grown and it's on soccer fields all over America. Do you think that women's soccer is growing in the way that we maybe predicted a decade ago?
I'm not sure we could have predicted. I mean, that the 99 World Cup team, you know, that win was obviously a big catalyst, and it sprung what is now three leagues since then. And you can kind of only hope that the leagues take their foothold and that they continue to grow. And you kind of hope that decisions like this and the overarching community and the umbrella, you know, have the trickle-down effects and just help it grow, because it is. And it's growing kind of in the same way that the MLS is growing, at least I think. You know, it's got stronger footholds in certain regions, like Pacific Northwest, But you, again, you really just kind of have to hope that these bigger decisions kind of help its roots grow.
Sean, you have a thought on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, Allie was an incredible player, played for the Boston Breakers as well as Duke University. But, yeah, I mean, I think that as far as the conversation about the how this new revelation in hopefully reforming FIFA could affect the women's game, I think that it's going to create a much more clear pathway to the discussion of the unequal resources devoted to the women's game. I think that conversation is really going to find new legs if there is reform with inside the organization.
Allison, thank you so much for the phone call. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, guys.
And when we come back, we're going to take some more phone calls at 860-275-7266. Talk more about this FIFA scandal and what impact it may have on soccer, but also talk about youth soccer. We're going to be talking about the popularity of the sport. And as somebody asks on Facebook, Michael has a question, do you think Hartford could support a Major League Soccer team? We'll ask that question coming up in a little bit as we talk soccer here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live.
I saw World Cup, baby. No, no. A few soccer fans, the rest of you are going,
That's like football without pads, right?
For the rest of the world, it's football. For us, it's like
a strange sport played by damaged people.
That's the late Robin Williams, who frequently talked about soccer in his stand-up act. We're talking today about the sport just ahead of the Women's World Cup, which starts next week. And in the wake of this FIFA scandal, are you a diehard soccer fan? Are you involved in youth soccer right here in Connecticut? Do you just not understand the hype? We'd like to have you join the conversation, 860-275-7266. We're joined in studio today by Sean Mecki, who's a color analyst for CPTV sports coverage of soccer. He's also director of goalkeeping at the FSA FC Youth Soccer Club in Farmington. Tom Loke is president of the American Outlaws Hartford chapter. It's an organization of U.S. soccer fans. And joining us from our New Haven studio is Christine Huber, who's director of the Connecticut Football Club and general manager of the CFC Arena in Hampden Hall, soccer coach also. Again, if you want to join us on Facebook and Twitter, it's at Where We Live. Let's get a quick phone call here. Steve is calling from Wyndham. Hi there, Steve. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for taking my call here. What do you guys think about Blatter? What a thief, really, honestly. I mean, they've been talking about this for decades, this guy, Steven. I'm so glad they took him down. I think he could only be taken down in the United States, by the way. And who's going to replace him? I'd like to see what Coach Klinsmann of the American, that guy really revamped the American team. I look this, who do you guys want to replace Blatter?
Okay, so who do you guys want to replace Sepp Blatter? Not that we're going to have any particular say in this. Tom, I'll go to you first.
No, I have to plug my my co-president of the American Outlaws D.C. chapter, Donald Wine. He's putting his name in for candidacy. You know, the chances are, I'm sure he doesn't have the financial backing as some of these other guys do, but no, I think he'd do a great job. But, you know, the main candidates, I really do like Prince Ali. I think he's got a good stake to go forward. It's going to be interesting to see if, you know, some of Sepp's older guys kind of step in. And, you know, Platini, you don't know what you're going to get with him. You don't know if it's going to be the same corruption. It'll be interesting to see who really is the front runners in a couple weeks once, you know, we start to see what happens.
Christine Huber, I mean, what do you think needs to happen at soccer's governing body to really institute some change over the course of time? Because I think for many people, again, in America, this scandal is the first time they've really considered this, even though the corruption allegations have been going back decades. What do you think needs to happen to really change this? Because this isn't like a U.S. sports league that's run like the NFL. This is actually a kind of a global body, not unlike the UN. It just operates on its own. It's got to change somewhat if it's going to be able to maintain this enormous fan base of billions of people.
Yeah, I think the big thing is implementing some checks and balances right away. They're saying right now it probably won't even elect anybody for another 4 months. So I believe Blatter's going to stay on and still kind of run FIFA, from what I understand, until they sign somebody else.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Remy's in Milford. Hi, Remy.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's up?
So just a quick comment. Why soccer is so popular is in Europe, obviously everything is about money, but the whole point about soccer is that it's structured in a way where there's a first division, second division, third division, and so forth. And if you're not performing in the top division, you get relegated to the second division. And so you want to keep, you know, make money, you got to keep performing to stay in the top division. And all the players are not just searched with pounds, they're searched globally. So, you know, like Messi, Ronaldo, I mean, one's from Argentina, one's from Portugal, they're all playing in Spain, for instance, just because right now it's the best division. But it's the pool of players is not local, it's global.
It's global. You know, and Remy, thank you very much. It's interesting, though, Sean, because a lot of sports have become very global. The NFL, I'll say, not so much, and it's still the most popular sport in America by a very, very long shot. But we see baseball growing as a global game. Hockey has long been a global game. And many, many sports that are played at the youth level are games that draw people from all over the place. Soccer has always had that advantage, though. It is a place that brings together people of all sorts of different backgrounds, all sorts of different languages onto one team.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've gone to places where I don't speak the language with, you know, I'll be visiting on vacation, for instance, or on a school trip, and soccer is kind of that easy barrier to break down immediately. You don't even need to know more than 3-4 words to be able to play soccer with a group of people who you have nothing else in common with. And in that sense, it is a great way of bringing people together.
Is there... Sean, do you see a passion differential between Americans who love the sport and play the sport and people that you know or work with from overseas who come from more soccer-loving countries? Is there really a deficit that maybe we have to bridge where we may love something else like football, American football, very, very much, but the soccer passion from overseas is just much more than we can match?
I think it's a little bit overestimated, honestly, that disparity. I think... You know, the people here who are passionate about it are every bit as passionate as anyone anywhere throughout the world. And if you go to those countries, there are people there who say, football, football, I'm tired of hearing about football. You know, there's other things that are far more important. So, you know, I think on the whole, per capita, the U.S. doesn't care as much about soccer as much of the rest of the world does, but it's catching up. And those of us here who are passionate about it are just as passionate.
Our friends from the Roper Center sent us this. 30% of people aged 18 to 29 identify as soccer fans. That's nearly twice as much as compared to other age groups. Is that what you see, Tom?
Absolutely. I was going to say, you know, our AO Hartford organization, those are the most passionate fans I know personally. And it's just cool to see, you know, I know overseas how much, you know, football means to everybody. It's their way of life. And it is ours as well. So, I mean, you know, to go back on what he said, the passionate fans here are on, I'd say, level with, you know, the Europeans and South Americans. And it's just cool to see it grow.
David is calling from Avon. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Hi there, David. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's up?
Nothing. Love the show. I listen to you a lot, and I'm so happy you brought this subject up. I am a diehard. I'm an immigrant. I moved here from Liverpool at the age of 10. Liverpool is a big staple in football in England and Europe. And just, I think that the U.S., I'm so happy that the U.S. got involved in this FIFA thing, because I think it's the only country that could actually bring them somewhat to their knees, because the rest of Europe and Africa and South America is such entwined with FIFA that they didn't have the power to bring this down. And I'm happy because the U.S. is young and coming up in this, and you can actually watch more football here in the States than you can literally in the rest of the world because of the TV rights. And there's so much money in the TV rights, and they own the money to it, and that's where, you know, the bulk of the money comes from. And just to see that they actually can be somewhat brought to their knees and have to answer to the questions that they so often, like, we don't have to answer to you. We don't have to tell you what to do. We can just, you know, if another country, we were like, oh, we're going to do this or that, they're like, oh, guess what? You're not invited to the next World Cup. That's how much power they have. And that's a big blow to a nation.
You know, it's interesting, too, and I'm glad you called up and told us about your heritage from Liverpool. One of the stories about Sepp Blatter and his rule over FIFA is he seemed to have a sort of a long-running vendetta against England, and that probably was exacerbated by Andrew Jennings, who we heard from off the top of the program, the journalist who sort of doggedly gone after FIFA. As much, David, as I suppose U.S. prosecutors were involved, I think that the British press probably played as large a role in this as anybody else.
I agree with you, and but they were just put aside because the warning to them was, well, if you keep this up, you're not invited to the next World Cup. And that is devastating to the people. Like, this is, and I know this is new to the U.S., but this is not a game. This is a religion. This is a passion. And I've had many, you know, I'm a diehard Red Sox fan, diehard Patriots fan. And I've actually, one of my good friends that I met here in the U.S., I took him to the Roma-Liverpool game at Fenway about 3 years ago. And he was always like, I don't understand this game. This is crazy. But like, he went to the game with me, and ever since, he has been a diehard Liverpool fan. He's like, this is insane. This is great. The passion, the love. And he knew nothing about the game. And he calls me like almost every other day with like transfer news and this, that, and the other thing. And it's, it catches on quick.
Well, David, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I asked Sean Mecki about this, Christine Huber, but could you talk about that passion that we hear from fans who maybe grew up someplace else, or fans like Tom Lokay, who clearly grew up in the United States but really, really love it? There seems to be some sort of a passion about this sport for those who love it that you maybe don't even see around other sports.
Yeah, especially here, you know, in New Haven with the melting pot and everybody coming in from all different backgrounds and countries. It's just, I mean, New Haven is, you know, I'm part of the AO New Haven, and it's just, you know, insane how obsessed and how much people love their teams. It's great atmosphere down here in New Haven.
Could you explain, Tom, what exactly American Outlaws is? I mean, how do you organize fans? What is it you guys do?
Well, you know, we took that, you know, if you went to a game maybe 10 years ago or so, there wasn't anywhere to meet up for all the fans. There weren't parties. There wasn't a supporter section that was, you know, really well run. So, you know, what the American Outlaws try and accomplish is they try and bring in as many U.S. fans as we can. We try and encompass, you know, all walks of life. You know, we're very welcoming. We love all of our members. Membership here in Hartford's grown over 480 members. I mean, it's just cool to see how many people do love the U.S. national teams and you know, once you give them a place to come watch with other fans and you start to build those connections over the years, you know, we always say it's an American Outlaws family. And, it's really become that way because we all share the same passion. So we all come together. You know, we watch games together. We travel together. You know, we go to cookouts together now. It's cool. We're just all growing with the sport, with each other, with other chapters like New Haven, you know, all the other New England chapters. It's great to see.
I want to get to Dee, who's calling from Hartford. Hi there, Dee. Go ahead.
Hi, I would just like to get the input from the group about the lack of U.S. youth in colleges and universities being utilized on those soccer teams, and perhaps how it may or may not develop future players for our national team.
So you're talking about the number of homegrown players on U.S. college teams. You say that there's more foreign-born players ending up in U.S. college teams, Adi?
Correct.
Yeah. Sean Mecki, do you have a thought?
I have a lot of thoughts on that.
Yeah, so talk to us about it.
Well, I'm a former college coach myself. I've coached men's and women's college soccer. What you will find on the women's side is it is almost entirely American-born student-athletes, whereas on the men's side, it's not. And that's not to say that there aren't some foreign players who look at our women's college soccer as a great way to come and prove themselves, actually. It's a legitimate pathway to development toward a pro or international career on the women's side. On the men's side, you know, there is a big debate about whether or not men's college soccer is actually helping players get to our national team system or get to a professional career. And at the end of the day, you know, they're working hard to try and become relevant again and change some of the bylaws of the NCAA that make it difficult to really progress during your 4 years at college, just due to the lack of competition, the lack of training throughout the year. But as to the American-born versus foreign-born conversation, you know, that all comes back to the fact that these coaches are trying to win, and the very best player that they can bring into their school, they're going to bring in. Their job is on the line. And if they feel that they can get a player better somewhere else and that's their model, they're going to do that. And there are some coaches who firmly believe in bringing in American talent and that the cohesion of that team is the right way forward. And others are looking for maybe some talent that got discarded from a pro youth system somewhere in Europe.
You know, it's interesting we talk about this because we talk about education and higher education on our program an awful lot. And in that scenario is actually not that unlike what is happening to schools like UConn across the board, and not just in athletics. The fact is that the University of Connecticut, for instance, used to be a place where if you grew up in Connecticut, you could rightly assume that if you got good enough grades, you could go to your state school. Now it's become so competitive, and there are students from all over the world coming in. A big school like UConn has become a place where whether or not you're a soccer player or a physicist, you're going to have a lot of competition from around the world. And in that way, Sean, it seems like soccer is kind of just mirroring the rest of academia.
Yeah, and also mirroring the greater conversation about athletics and colleges and the relationship of intercollegiate sports to the universities, and that whole conversation about are student athletes professionals in some way. And you know, that's a bigger conversation, I think, for possibly another great show.
If you want to call us, 860-275-7266. Christine Huber joins us down the line from New Haven. And Christine is director of the Connecticut Football Club. Can you tell us about CFC?
Yeah, CFC is one of the biggest soccer clubs in Connecticut, if not the Northeast. This year alone, we wound up sending 90 seniors off to play college soccer, which is a pretty amazing stat when you think about it. So at the CFC Arena, we actually start clinics at age 2 now. So I know I said I started at 5, and Sean said he started at 4. The parents are getting them in younger and younger, so we start at 2, and the classes are sold out.
Wow, the classes are sold out. So, I mean, tell us about the parents who are getting their kids involved in soccer and what these young students learn. Obviously, the only pipeline isn't to get people scholarships and into colleges and then maybe even pro careers. There's a lot more to it than just that, I would assume, with these large numbers.
Yeah, I think soccer is a great sport to start off with the young ones. We're not just sending them out there with a ball and letting them play. We're actually teaching them teamwork, cooperation. Most of the two-year-olds can already stop the ball with their foot. And then by 3, they're already working on a step-over move. So they're more advanced than just, you know, throw them out there with a mom and dad and you know, letting the kids run loose. It's actually a very structured class. And I think as we keep going, you're going to see the numbers increase. And whether they play other sports, you know, that's fine as well. But you're going to see soccer participation, I think, keep growing.
It's interesting, Christina. I've heard a number of reports about American soccer and will it ever rise to the level of the great powers in the sport. There was also recently a story about Chinese soccer on NPR about the same thing, about whether or not if you start teaching people the right techniques at a young enough age, you can over time begin to build a kind of a soccer dynasty, the type that they have in Germany, say. Do you think there's something to that? Do you think that teaching all the skills at 3 and 4 years old consistently over decades will start to make the American game rival that of the other great powers that we see?
Well, I think the greater participation, the greater chance we have for having athletes to compete against each other. You know, when they start getting older, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, they get better by playing against better players. So maybe 20 years ago when players just started playing at like 8, not everyone was as talented. Now at 9 and 10, you're going to see talented youth players, and they're going against other talented youth players, which hopefully will raise the competition. And again, kind of like a trickle up, hopefully that will lead to greater U.S. national team players.
Sean, what do you think about that? That pathway and whether or not the teaching of the game at the youngest possible level is something that over time will start to develop the U.S. into a great soccer nation?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some merit to that. I think it's a case of higher participation numbers meeting greater resources. You know, the greater resources are everything that Christine was just talking about, and this structure for these better players to have a pathway to meet a challenge that maybe they would not have met in what used to be a very amateur system. But I think really the most key element to our national teams and our soccer culture in general and improving is just the participation numbers, which are surging and growing every single year.
We actually just got a tweet here that says, you should call a parent of a kid aged 5 to 12 because they are all soccer experts. We'll get some more on youth soccer in just a moment, but I want to get to Kat in Plainville quickly. Hi, Kat, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I actually have 8-year-old twins, a boy and a girl, and my husband grew up in England. And my son never wanted to play any kind of sport until he watched the World Cup last year. And now every Saturday morning, the TV is on, and Daddy and son are watching Manchester City. My son has Aguero posters in his room, Manchester City jersey. I mean, this kid eats, sleeps soccer, and he says it's because football and baseball are not exciting, and they're kind of boring to watch. So he loves the excitement, and he is a great player. He's really, really developing his skills and just really loves the game, and it's awesome. It's really, really awesome, and I think that's why the soccer fans are just more – they're just more emotional. It just makes it more exciting to watch the game and to play the game.
Hey, Kat, I have to ask you one question, though. If your husband didn't grow up in England and have this great love for Manchester City, do you think that it would still happen in your house the same way?
Well, I'm Italian, so when the World Cup was on, my family was watching it. So anytime we were at my parents' house or my uncle's house, or my son was watching the game, and he was really getting involved, and just, it's crazy because even just from him watching it, he's telling his soccer coach what kind of penalty kick, is it a kick or a throw, because his coach doesn't even know all the specifics of the game. I mean, it's just, he's so involved when he watches it, he's learning so much just from watching it, the little that he has.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for sharing the story. I really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. When we come back from our break, we'll continue with Sean Mecki, who's a color analyst for CPTV Sports Soccer Coverage and also a soccer coach. Tom Loke, who's president of the American Outlaws, the Hartford chapter. It's an organization of U.S. soccer fans. And Christine Huber is director of the Connecticut Football Club, general manager of the CFC Arena, and Hampden Hall soccer coach. Join us again on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, two leaders of NPR's Diversity Project will join us to look more closely at how the media covers diversity. We'll also talk with a scholar whose criticism of the whiteness of public radio has gained a lot of attention lately. Hope you can join us for this conversation tomorrow. I also invite you to join me this afternoon at 4 p.m. for a conversation on race with Ta-Nehisi Coates, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's being honored as the 2015 Stowe Prize winner for his work addressing social and civil justice issues. This event is happening right across the street from the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center in Hartford at the beautiful Emmanuel Congregational Church. If you'd like more information, just check out our Where We Live Facebook page at Where We Live. Hope to see you this afternoon. Today we're talking about soccer in America in the wake of this FIFA scandal and just in front of the Women's World Cup. We're talking with Sean Mecki, Tom Loke, and Christine Huber, and with you at 860-275-7266. Let's quickly get to Steve in Southbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
Not much. Just wanted to talk about how what the U.S. needs to do is we're the only country, I think, in the world now that it's pay to play to develop our youth. Kids got to be able to just learn on their own, grow their love for the game, and just be creative. And they don't need to be paying thousands of dollars a year to be doing that. Every other country, if a kid is decent, he gets to go to a club for free. They take them in, they teach. A lot of kids don't play organized soccer till they're 12, 13, 14 years old in other countries, and we've got them at 2, 3, 4, 5 years old paying hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a year.
Mm.
I just don't see us developing, because there's a lot of kids that can't afford these things in inner cities, and I know they offer scholarships, but we're missing the boat on a lot of this stuff.
Steve, I think you raise a great point, and Sean Mecki, I'm going to bet you have thoughts about this.
Without a doubt. I think, you know, this is a talking point frequently. Working in my profession, I obviously have a little bit of a bias, but not so much that I lose perspective. I mean, it's a little bit of a misconception that we're the only country in the world with this pay-to-play system. That's not entirely true. In fact, the most commonly voiced counterexample is England, where supposedly everyone who ever played the game does it for free, and that's not entirely true. There are definitely pay-to-play systems in England as well. But the caller's point is very true, that there is an infrastructure in place in many of these old soccer countries where the moment you have any talent or ability, you might get picked up out of a county park and just whisked away to a fully paid-for youth soccer experience. That's the money is driven there too. So it's a different side of the money. You're talking about the professional clubs have a vested interest in finding anyone and everyone who can either help their club or become a commodity that they can sell to another club. And, you know, careful what you wish for. That is coming. It's coming here to the United States as well. And they're, every single MLS team that is in the league now is required to have a fully funded academy system. And these players do not pay money to be a part of their academy teams. And the system is spreading, but the country is so big that how do you serve all of the players in the country in that manner?
You know, it's interesting because you just said, you know, what you wish for down the road, you see the way that the basketball system works in America. Kids are scooped up out of playgrounds and taken through very expensive programs run by sneaker companies. You see other programs in other sports. This is something that does happen all the time. Maybe soccer is treated a little bit differently, in part because we see soccer, Sean, as a suburban sport in America. People can afford to play it. There's the open space for all these fields. People have the minivans that drive the kids around places. Maybe it's just the perception of the sport and where it's played.
Well, I think the interesting thing, too, is just that, you know, there are players who – the expense of the sport is driven by the fact that in order to pay for these dedicated, full-time, knowledgeable coaches – The clubs have a large expense on their hands, and so the fees to be a part of these clubs can be exorbitant. And the more talented the coaches, the more expensive, the more exorbitant the fees. And I think one of the reasons for this proliferation of this very expensive pay-to-play system that is youth soccer is just that it gets watered down. You've got some very good clubs, and the fees are high, and then you've got other clubs where – you know, there are just players that should be, in my opinion, participating at a recreational level at a very low cost in a program that's sponsored by their town. But there are hundreds and hundreds of premier teams in each age group just in Connecticut that are essentially paying these $1,000 plus fees to be a part of the equivalent of what should be, in my opinion, a travel program.
Christine, do you have thoughts on this?
I think we've kind of created our own monster with it. We don't see the kids outside just going to the park, playing 4-on-4, pick up, you know, the trash cans. You just don't see that anymore. You know, we're paying for the quality coaches, and that's up, you know, to the parents and what they want to do. I think it kind of needs to start from the top, and we have, you know, our ODP program, and I think that should really be a free-based program where we take – the best kids from Connecticut, no matter, you know, how much it costs. Let's take those best kids, regardless of club affiliation, and let's get them to compete against the other states and the other states' best players. I think that's kind of where it all begins.
When you say ODP, what do you mean?
That's the Olympic Development Program. So each state basically has an Olympic Development Program where, in theory, it's not supposed to be based on expenses or costs. You're supposed to just get those dedicated quality athletes, and you take the best ones from Connecticut and you go off and you play Virginia or New Hampshire or anyone else. You play their state's best players.
Okay, Tom, we've got a few minutes left here, and we got a question from Michael on Facebook. Do you think Hartford could support a major league soccer team? So this is a big question. Hartford always thinks of, you know, if we don't have major league sports here, nothing's going to work. We're trying to get the Whalers back for the last 15 years. Do you think that we could support an MLS team here in this area?
I think realistically, the first step will be to see if we can support an NASL team. And the answer to that question is absolutely. I think that, you know, the fans here, you look at the UConn fans, you look at the soccer fans that support the United States team, like Teague said earlier, the New Haven Gooners, the Liverpool fans as well. I mean, there's just enough. The fans here are dedicated. They want a pro team to support. You know, they don't want a yard goats. They want a professional soccer team. They want a Whalers. That, you know, we have UConn. It's just something that we absolutely can support. And I think when the time comes, it's something that we're going to prove to the nation that we are supporting.
And there's talk about developing a new soccer stadium somewhere in Hartford, right? I mean, is this going to happen?
We think so. We hope so. There's been a few reports that have come out that are very promising. You know, while we wait for an announcement, hopefully the league will consider to bring Hartford in. And when they do, you know, we can guarantee that the support will be, you know, some of the best in the country, if not the best.
You know, we just have a couple minutes left, Sean. But, you know, we always talk about soccer as this thing that's about to take over America once again. It happened back in the 1980s when we saw international stars come to play here, and it began to grow at the youth level, and then it sort of waned again a little bit. And then there was that boom again around women's soccer that we talked about, in which people were playing, both boys and girls, and we thought maybe this is a sport that's going to grow again. Do you see this as a time of potential renaissance where, you know, we clean up the top of this kind of rotten organization that's skimming money and making sure that the fan doesn't get everything that they could, and start to say, you know, soccer could be something that really does explode here in America?
Well, I think it kind of already has exploded. I mean, you've got over 3 million kids in the U.S. playing soccer. That's more than anywhere else in the world. So as far as, you know, a renaissance, I think what you get is every 4 years you get a World Cup where the whole world is watching. And even here in the U.S., everybody stopped to watch or at least take note of what the U.S. men's national team was doing, even if they weren't interested, because they recognized the global importance of it from a fan perspective. So every 4 years you get this huge measuring stick, and all the measurements that you can take, the viewer ratings, the sponsorship money, the television rights just becoming more and more expensive, it's showing that every 4 years we have grown exponentially. In 2014 versus 2010 with the World Cup, you know, we grew by 66% in terms of the television, the cost of the television coverage, and in terms of the viewership as well. So it's going to continue to keep growing.
Christine Huber, before I let you go, I mean, what do you expect to see at this Women's World Cup, which is very exciting and starting just this week coming up?
Yeah, USA is kicking off this week. I think it's going to be a tough road for U.S. They are in the group of death, so they're playing number 5 Sweden, number 10 Australia, and number 33 Nigeria, and those are the rankings in the world. So they definitely have the hardest group to go through. From the scrimmages and from their friendlies, they looked pretty good. Their back line looked good. Their defense looked good. Hope Solo obviously did well in goal. It's about, you know, finishing their chances, and I'm interested to see who starts and who gets the playing time up front. We've got Morgan coming back from a knee injury. She should be good to go. Wambach, whether she starts or not. And then the person to keep your eye on, I think, is Kristen Press up top.
Is there a worry that because the women's team has not won in the last few World Cup appearances, that there's disappointment that people are waiting for, as opposed to just watching to see how they do and actually seeing this team as an underdog in some way?
Yeah, I have a feeling we're not really considered an underdog. I think everyone in the country is expecting us to win. I think that puts a lot of pressure on the players, but they know that, they feel that, and hopefully they're going to thrive off of it.
Tom, do you have a thought about this as you look at the Women's World Cup? Do you think that this is another year in which women's soccer can jump to the top of the national consciousness, maybe not just even with a win, but with players who will help to captivate the imagination?
Absolutely. I think Women's World Cup coming up is very exciting. We can't wait to host events for them and show the same support that we have for the men. I think it's critical that, you know, the women do get the same support that the men get, because the support on the Men's World Cup last year was, you know, exponential. We couldn't have imagined how many fans came out. You know, if we see that happen again for the women, it's great for the sport. It's great for, you know, U.S. soccer in general. And it's something that we can definitely drive more people to, you know, kind of more awareness to the women's game and kind of help them grow as well. You know, we can't let them get left behind.
Tom Lokay is president of the American Outlaws, Hartford chapter, an organization of U.S. soccer fans. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks to Christine Huber, who's director of the Connecticut Football Club and also a soccer coach at Hampden Hall. She joined us from the New Haven studios today. Thank you, Christine, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to Sean Mecki, who is a soccer coach himself, and he's also a color analyst for CPTV Sports soccer coverage. Sean, great to have you here. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, John.
Our program today is produced by Tucker Ives, Kyone Wolf, Lori Mack, Lydia Brown, and Betsy Kaplan. Thanks to Anna Geismar and Jules Lefebvre for their help on today's show. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer is Katie Solarski. Thanks to our interns, Katie McAuliffe and Deborah Timms. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.